This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 24th of August 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today we're asking, where have all the nightclubs gone? A recent survey revealed that half the nightclubs in the UK have closed in the last decade. So have we stopped going out? Have we become a nation enthralled to the pipe and slippers brigade? And it's not just here. New York, that city that never slept, has a bad case of narcolepsy as it's become tougher to dance, let alone drink or smoke or make a noise in Manhattan. We'll take an international look at a global gripe. We'll be in Beirut, where parties are louder than bombs. We'll speak to a music mogul in Seoul to see what's got that city moving out to festivals to go dancing. And we'll be out and about in London to see if people are having their vibe killed.
The night is kind of a place where people who don't really belong in a city have a voice. That's their place. That's our world, you know?
That's all coming up on this week's edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. So where have all the nightclubs gone? There were 3,144 in 2005. There are now only 1,733 in 2015, according to very recent records. That's in the UK. Are people staying in? Does the fall in alcohol consumption amongst the early 20-somethings mean that clubland is dead? If so, what else are they doing instead? Or is gentrification to blame? A club that makes a neighbourhood viable gets shut down once new residents move in. Or is the music just crap? What on earth is spoiling the party? Few people know better than Alan Miller, chairman of the UK's Nighttime Industries Association and one of the founders of Hackney's reimagined Truman Brewery, including his own now dearly departed Vibe Bar. And Alan is our first guest.
We co-founded the Old Truman Brewery, and just to give it a snippet, originally that was seen as a bit of a no-go area. Yeah. It was seen as an objective two area in terms of social and economic considerations, and many people said no one will ever go there. But by anchoring the development to attract creative industries around bar and nighttime activity, it created a catalyst and a magnet that then snowballed, basically, because more and more young people got involved, and the rest is history, to the extent that quite some years ago, the World Bank and others cited it as an example of urban regeneration. The reason I mention all of that is because it really tells the tale of how important nighttime activity is for the daytime as well, in terms of regenerating areas, but also in terms of the high street and activity that brings in cultural and economic capital.
You talked about attracting the Truman Brewery setup, which seemed revolutionary actually when that opened in the early 90s in Brick Lane. And you talked about attracting the creative industries. Opening a nightclub, doing anything that is essentially inviting people to a party, you pay to get in, you pay for the drinks, all the rest of it. But the idea is that you're forming a perfect party there. That is a creative industry in itself. Is that the peril that we send a message by closing nightclubs, by revoking late licences, etc., that we send out a very negative message to creative industries generally?
Well, I think that it could be, and the question is, but things are not inevitable. So, what one does and how we do things determines the kind of world we want to live in. So recently, the We Love Hackney campaign in one of the boroughs in London, residents and local businesses got together, over 4,000 people petitioned. That's double the amount of most of the elected councillors, to say that actually they don't agree with the idea that it's not considered appropriate to have more clubs in certain areas in Hackney. So I think that we can actually have a voice and say and challenge these things. That's the first important thing. I think a lot has been said about gentrification. I tend to think that improvements in infrastructure and housing stock and shops and all of those things are a positive thing. We have a much bigger issue in the UK, which is, and everyone's been talking about it, the lack of housing. That puts pressure on everyone. It puts pressure on buyers. It puts pressure on any rented accommodation and rented businesses. And I think the thing is that we need a really ambitious house building and campaign in the UK, maybe 5 million houses over the next couple of years. Now, having said that, The thing that is of most challenge at the moment is the authorities' outlook. The police kind of end up wanting to hold the industry accountable for when there are issues around nighttime because they're concerned about resources, and it looks like an easy win because we haven't been represented up until recently. So, you know, independent bars, even really big chains, are very scared to put their head above the parapet. You've got this kind of crazy moment where legal businesses are almost being held accountable as though they're criminals, being held responsible for not only activity in their venues, but outside down the road. And people are asking questions like, where did you have your last drink if someone commits a crime? In terms of attracting creativity, and it is a creative endeavour, and it's very nice you say that about the Truman Brewery. I mean, I think that one of the reasons why Detroit has invited the Berlin Club Commission in to talk about clubs and bars is because there's a recognition internationally, whether it be São Paulo or New York or anywhere, that when nighttime activity comes along, it helps spur and create very interesting cultural and economic activity. Then the question becomes, how do you continue that dynamism? Now, the thing is, obviously, I'm not here to protect or say that businesses that just aren't up to the mark or keeping up with trends should stay. You know, people vote with their feet and they do what they like. But it's a bit of a myth that somehow that the clubs are just not good enough anymore. I mean, some, of course, may not be. One of the problems we've got, like, for instance, in London, not to be too London-centric, is that there's so many big clubs have gone in the last 2 years, over 10, that now there's an enormous pressure on the bigger clubs that do exist. When people are deciding generally to go to Berlin every weekend or Barcelona rather than put up with all the hassles of everything from ID scanners to breathalyzers in some places, lots of security, there's a whole thing about increasing regulation.
You mentioned Barcelona and Berlin, Alan. What are they doing right that London's not doing right at the moment?
You can go to Berlin and Barcelona and Berlin. There's very...
Because it's not aggro. It's very late night scene, exactly. But it's not aggro.
Well, they're open all night, quite a lot of the places. That's the first thing. I would say that when we've got 24-hour legal licensing in the UK, we should have some of that. Not everywhere, but we should have some of that. We should have tiered finishing, tiered closing. All the research has always demonstrated that throughout the night, if people leave at different times, it's better for everyone. Now, with a night tube coming to London, that's going to have important consequences. So we should have more 24-hour licensing across the UK like they do. They are far more relaxed in terms of regulating. However, they're well-behaved and serious. They still have security. But once again, people are not animals. They don't go out. They're not, you know, people want to go out and have a good time and have fun. You know, I think it's important for us to remember that we're not talking about convicted felons generally who are going out, you know, doing terrible things. We're talking about people in Britain and visitors, tourists and young people who make up the fabric of our society. Let's not think of them as being needed to be herded and prodded and as though somehow they're out of control. And let's be a bit more grown up about it. Let's not focus so much on this industry. Let's remember how much economic value and cultural capital it brings and deal with the consequences when they're there. But let's have the authorities and others concentrate on the really important issues that are surrounding it elsewhere, not so much here.
And just finally, as I'm sure you know, Amsterdam has such a thing as a nightmare, a mayor for the nighttime.
Yeah.
Does London need a character like this?
Well, Mirik Milan is a friend and on our sort of advisor on our team, yeah. And he's done really good things there in the relationship between business and policymakers in Amsterdam. In Berlin, as I've mentioned, they have a club commission, which is slightly different, where they have a coalition of different people that also act as an interface. I think that whatever form it takes, the relationship between business and policymakers and citizens is an important one. And we're pushing that in terms of lobbying, in terms of discussions with the Home Office, DCLG, the Mayor's Office of London. We want to act as a conduit. And we're saying, use us. On the one hand, don't punish our industry for when there's individual acts. But on the second, use us. Make us the great brand and PR for the UK to help attract trade and investment. We're a great asset and a tool, not a problem. In our recent report Forward Into the Night, we put some of those arguments forward, and we would encourage as many people in the UK, particularly owners, to join us. But that's the thing that we really want to focus on.
Forward Into the Night, indeed. Alan Miller from the Nighttime Industries Association. Thank you very much. Now, we've heard about the problems that London's nightclub owners and promoters are facing. We're now going to hear from a few whose long-serving and much-adored establishments have been closed down, starting with Marcus Harris, who used to run the White Heat Club at Soho's Madame Jojo's, which closed its doors at the end of last year.
I've been sort of working in and around clubs for the last 10 years. I guess the main difference now
is when I was 16, 17, there was a plethora of clubs in central London, and there wasn't really so much stuff in East. And the biggest difference is probably the shift East, but also there's a lot of clubs that have been lost along the way. People talk of Man and JoJo's being an institution, and I don't think they realise actually quite how institutionalised it was. It was still kind of operated like a nightclub might have been 20 years ago, you know, with pretty much zero regard for the law. And that's why it got shut down. But saying that, in Soho in general, over the time that I've been running events there and running nights there and doing things there and going out there, the amount of clubs that have shut or been shut down or had their licensing hours, you know, reduced and taken away and stripped back to kind of a bare minimum, it does fall into this wider narrative of Westminster Council basically going, we want Soho to be an area for families, going to the theatre, going for dinner, going home by midnight. And basically, somewhere like Madame Jojo's with a 3 a.m. license, seven nights a week, doesn't fit into that. The thing about London is I always had this really strong youth culture and underground culture kind of aesthetic and movements that have kind of come out of London, or that London itself has heavily influenced, whether they've come from elsewhere, and like it's a thing that we've taken on and, you know, expressed through our city. And I don't think you can do that without clubs and the night, because the night is kind of a place where people who don't really belong in a city have a voice. That's their place. That's our world, you know? I don't think anywhere will replace Madame Jojo's. I don't think it's possible. I think it was so much to so many different people. You know, it was kind of burlesque, it was gay, it was transvestite, it was indie, it was a disco place, it was a place where you go to listen to like rare soul records. And nothing will ever replace that, because it was so unique. You could put all those nights somewhere else in a different building, a mile down the road, or half a mile down the road, or 100 metres down the road, and it wouldn't be the same. There was something in there that was a hangover from everything that had happened there.
Hi, my name is Raymond Stevenson, and I used to own Imperial Gardens Nightclub. Imperial Gardens was one of the first nightclubs that was built in a railway arch. We built it ourselves. The overall emphasis of the nightclub was to support artists and to support DJs and to support up-and-coming producers. And it was just about putting Camberwell on the map, and it definitely did that. So it was interesting. They were interesting times. It was off the back of the kind of illegal rave scene. So the council was more willing to allow people to have licenses. And then I brought a nightclub myself, and we got a 6 o'clock license, and it was opposed, but I think in the wisdom of the local council, they realized that having a venue like ours in the area would attract other businesses. So it all started off rosily. And then we ran into the council. Our local council decided to build flats 3 meters away, and they didn't inform us about the application. So those flats and the nightclub, they were not consistent land uses. And we knew we were gonna have to close down, and the council said they wouldn't make any provisions for us being there first. I can mention areas which have been saved by the nighttime economy. South London, Brixton, which was once a no-go area, now is a thriving area for young people to come and want to live there because of the bubbling nightlife. So I think the council have got to embrace it, and they've got to be brave. And some of the residents are very active and very political, and it's not really about the noise disturbance, it's just about the unfashionableness of having nightclubs next to them.
I always kind of look at this as being a sort of war of ideas. There's a group of people who essentially either haven't been to a nightclub in the last 40 years, or they never went to a nightclub, and they don't understand what goes on in these places. They think they're these sort of crack dens of decadence and debauchery, and it's not like that. It's people kind of sharing ideas, meeting new people, just being free, being themselves. And ultimately, like, no one can take that away from us. There isn't any way they can legislate against that. Like, people are going to do that anyway. And that's kind of what we've got to keep fighting for. We've just got to keep finding new ways, really, to, I guess, beat the system.
I think the shift will happen, but the shift is only going to happen with organisations such as us getting together and saying, hold on, it's not just individual nightclubs. You are talking to a mass of organisations who represent hundreds of thousands of people. And once you start putting it in those terms, the politicians start listening.
Thank you to Gaia Lutz, our roving reporter, for that report. After the break, we'll head out of London and find out about nightclubbing in Seoul. And we'll look to Beirut to see why their nightlife scene is thriving.
See that man sitting opposite you on the subway, lost in another world? Or the smart woman scribbling notes while having her flat white? Well, here's what links them. They're both listening to Monocle 24 via our robust new, upgraded and free radio app that simply and seamlessly lets you tune in live or download shows for later enjoyment. Come on, download the Monocle 24 app today. Stick on your headphones and have informed fun on the go. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Band, and today we're asking, where have all the nightclubs gone? And to help answer the question, we're now going to South Korea. Seoul's club scene is a lot of fun, I can vouch for that. But recently, the city has suffered for the closing of some of its best-loved dance floors. I spoke to Bernie Cho, president of record label and talent management company DFSB Collective, about the city's nightlife and whether these closures are down to changes in policy or personal taste. I bet I hard away to meet it, girl. All they got on each other was a me and me. And then you got on sexy as a nudity. So go, sir.
I think on the good news tip, when you look at the World DJ Magazine top 100 clubs of the year, Seoul, Korea has the number one club in Seoul called Octagon, which clocked in at number 6. That's the good news. The bad news is that last year they had 3 clubs in the top 100, making it the number one city in Asia for electronic dance music. But 2 of those clubs not only dropped off the list, but I think they've actually shut their doors as well. So it's definitely got people in the industry wondering, scratching their chins and their heads as to what's going on.
I mean, here in the UK, it's the same story as what's been happening in New York, certainly in Manhattan, where basically gentrification happens and the nightclubs and the bar owners that help to popularize an area and make real estate prices go up and make an area valid and safe, once residents move in, the clubs are forced to move out. Is this the case in Seoul, or is it a different story as to the closure of some of these clubs?
We're starting to see some similar things where a lot of these live clubs are actually becoming, ironically, victims of their own success by virtue of becoming so popular and so hip. It makes a lot of people want to move into that neighborhood, whether it be residents to cafes to stores. And then as a result, the rent keeps going up. And so what happens is, you know, the sort of epicenter of what made that area so hot gets pushed out. And so for a lot of club owners and a lot of club goers, popularity is actually, ironically, is what's killing these clubs.
And do they kind of move to the outskirts? Do they move to other areas? Do they become maybe part of festivals? I mean, I think festivals is a burgeoning scene in Asia and in Korea especially. What happens? Do they just kind of start up somewhere else?
What we're seeing right now is that the art school district here in Seoul called Hongdae, which is on the north side of the river, everyone knows Gangnam being the south, but on the north side of the river, the Hongdae Art School District, which has always been known as sort of the mecca for live music, indie music, has really made a resurgence lately because they've resurrected Live Club Day, which every last Friday of the month, for the price of one ticket, which is roughly about $20, you can get into about 10 different clubs all at once and see dozens to, you know, tens of, I don't know how many bands on a particular Friday. And what it's done is it's attracted tens of thousands of people to come back out to the live clubs. So it's been great for rock acts, urban acts, up-and-coming DJs. And so while the south side of the river super clubs are struggling a bit, we're seeing a resurgence on the north side. So,
can we see that in terms of musical taste, Bernie? The fact that, you know, as we know, in the 90s and noughties, you know, DJs bestrode clubs like Colossus, and now it's maybe more bands or it's more hip-hop acts that are doing that. Is it simply down to musical taste, or is it down to economics?
I think what's really interesting is the fact that for a lot of these superstar DJs that are coming into Korea into the bigger sort of clubs, they're actually going even bigger now by going to the outdoor festivals. So in fact, this summer, UMF, the Ultra Music Festival, their Seoul rendition became the largest EDM festival here in Asia, with at least 60,000 people packing the stadiums here. And so electronic dance music is not becoming less popular. It's just becoming popular, but in different spots and in different areas. So the money's being spent, and the people are still going out and having a good time. But when it comes to the north side of the river, to the Hongdae live club day scene, we're definitely seeing not only reflection, you know, underground at these small clubs, but that reflection is now being seen on the K-pop charts, where a lot of these indie live bands are now going neck and neck with boy bands and girl bands, and then also with a lot of summer festivals. These indie bands are now headliners.
Could you recommend a kind of quick fix, or maybe a long-term fix, for the Seoul music scene and for club culture? Is it really, in the end, a case of clubs having to almost own the building that they're in order to be able to survive?
Well, the irony is that in Korea, in Seoul right now, just as the live music scene in the art school district is really taking off and blowing up, there's actually a new tax law that's being imposed on these clubs, which is actually not only killing the goose, but actually asking, do you want the eggs fried or scrambled? What they're doing is they're forcing these clubs to re-register as bars. And ironically, not only will the taxes go up by 30%, but by law, bars are not allowed to be operating near schools. So it kind of defeats the purpose of having all these great clubs in an art school district. So the music scene here is very much up in arms in terms of this great live scene, this great club scene might get undercut by a law change that will pretty much defeat the purpose of building up this great music scene here in Korea. And so I think as much as it would be great that the clubs can own their own buildings, I think more than anything else, just making sure that there are tax laws in place that are reasonable so that these clubs can not only survive, but more importantly, thrive.
That was Bernie Cho, president of the DFSB Collective, the creative agency that specializes in the distribution of K-pop around the world. While London's nightclub scene might be going downhill, elsewhere in the world, nightlife industries are booming rather than being restricted. In Beirut, the clubbing scene has evolved a lot over the past few years, providing numerous indirect benefits to the often strife-stricken city, from providing a space for social interventions to improving Lebanon's international reputation. Venetia Rainey got her dancing shoes on to find out more.
Hi,
hey,
it's Venetia.
How are you? Welcome to Uber House headquarters.
I've come to the headquarters of one of Beirut's best-known nightlife companies, Uber House, to meet one of its founders, Ali Saleh. From humble beginnings, Uber House has grown into a hugely popular brand that attracts DJs from around the world, despite having numerous competitors. How did it manage to do that? The secret, Saleh says, is that it tapped into a growing desire for a different sort of clubbing experience.
The Lebanese clubbing scene was used to table service, restricted to bookers, not very acceptable to free minds, not very acceptable to low-income individuals. So the concept of Uber House was created as an electronic club that caters to this niche.
Originally located in the basement of his family's hotel in Hamra, the club was small, with a capacity of around 250 people. Within a year, however, it had established itself as a stalwart on a fast-evolving clubbing scene, even spawning a much larger open-air venue, the Garten.
It was a space for everyone to feel free. It was not just a club, it was a place where artists can come and show their work. It was a place where people can just come chill and relax and have a drink. It's no longer about blazers, cigars, and $600 shoes. It's more about having fun, going down, hitting the dance floor in whatever you want to wear, and just simply sweating out whatever troubles you've had all week long on the dance floor and just leaving it there.
With the Garten, Salah and the Uberhaus team set out to prove that clubs didn't need to be just about getting drunk and partying. They could also be cultural institutions that work within the local community.
The space was divided in a way that if you wanted to go for hardcore clubbing, you have that area for you, and you wanted to relax and just have a drink, you have that area for you, and there's a lot of activities going on a weekly basis, like we show movies, we do live shows of graffiti or different kinds of arts.
Another example of this social role came just this weekend, when Uberhaus organised a march from the Garten to downtown Beirut to join in with a civil society protest against government corruption. Later that evening, another club night, See You Next Sat, called off its event and urged people to join the demonstration instead. Salah says clubs can also show a different side to a city or country and help boost its global reputation. For Lebanon, a country constantly in the media for all the wrong reasons, this can only be a good thing.
Our concept is we bring in international artists on a weekly basis, and these artists are not just here to play. These artists are here to experience the country. They're here to experience the city. We aim at showing all of these artists a good time and showing them what Beirut is about. And these people take what they see in Lebanon and they spread it.
As a 28-year-old, Salah's adult life has been marked by negative experiences of Lebanon. Assassinations, war, civil strife, a refugee crisis. The list goes on. For him, nightclubs are a way to bring something different to the mix.
I'm a firm believer in the music and its effect on people's lives. I can't spend a day without music, and bringing in quality music, just maybe that could affect a few people and in a positive way. This is what we hope for. This is what we strive for. I believe we're doing something good for Beirut in general.
Late night noise, rowdy crowds, disorderly drunks. A booming nightlife scene can have plenty of drawbacks. But as Beirut shows, if clubs are allowed to flourish and get creative, they can also be a hugely positive influence. For Monocle in Beirut, I'm Venetia Rainey.
Thanks, Venetia. So where have all the nightclubs gone? Well, some of them have been turned into apartments. Some of them have been turned into nothing at all because apartments have been built next to them. Some of them have naturally shifted off this mortal coil to that great dance floor in the sky. Imagine St. Peter, earpiece affixed and meanly suited as the greatest nightclub bouncer of them all. In fact, as we've heard, nightlife has become a tighter and more nuanced negotiation between cities and their citizens in seemingly ever-shrinking urban areas. Where have all the nightclubs gone then? My sitting room. Only joking. They've gone to the fields of festivals and to towns less sniffy than mine. You've been listening to Culture on Monocle 24. My producer was Holly Studio 54 Fisher. Join us again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound. Thanks for tuning in.